Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
To another BritFlix.com podcast. And today's returning guest is Rich Pepiat. How are you, sir?
Very good. I mean, you say returning. I mean, that's quite a callback. I mean, it's like a decade.
9 years. So, I'm not having a decade. 9 years.
I mean, yeah, that's quite a long time. If it, actually, it was when you were talking to me and saying, you know, you've been on before. And I was like, geez, can't believe how long ago that was. That was the last film that I properly made was 9 years ago. Well, you know, it's not like I've not done anything in between. It's not like I've sat my ass, but it kind of shows that time does fly. And I've sort of been in the world of the wonderful world of advertising and branded content, that horrible word, and you know, TV, and stuff like that, and making short films and things like that. But I do remember probably 9 years ago thinking to myself, oh, you're in here. It's all going to be easy ridings now. You got your film on Netflix and off you go. And yeah, it ain't like that.
No, well, you know, just to make yourself feel comfortable about all that, I'm still, you know, that in that 9 years, I've been developing as a writer, thinking 9 years ago I was almost there, you know. And
I don't say anything that I've just said with any bitterness, because I think that it's ultimately you've got to be doing the work for yourself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you have to be working away, knowing that you're improving. It doesn't necessarily matter whether that those rejections are just part of the game. And I've had a fair few of them. And it's like you have to, I suppose, recognize that, okay, if that thing didn't get away, it's probably not because of all the reasons in your head that your face didn't fit or anything like that. It's just because the thing probably wasn't quite good enough.
Yeah,
and you have to be humble enough to then go, right, I'm going to have to go back to the drawing board and relook at it, or just put the thing in the bottom drawer and start again on something else. And that's really hard to do when you put so much into something and it doesn't get made. And then you go, right, it comes a point where you can keep spending time redrafting, reworking. And then it comes that hard day where you go, you know what, I'm just going to get on with something else. And the good thing is that when you suddenly do get something that gets a bit of momentum, everyone comes to you asking, well, what else you got? And you've got a whole drawer of scripts. And suddenly, amazingly, the thing that no one wanted 10 years ago, everyone now wants. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, it's not a waste of time.
I think the adage, you've got to be lucky, but then you've got to be ready to be lucky once you are lucky.
I think so. Yeah, but it's funny, though, because all those scripts in the bottom of my drawer that, you know, now I'm like, I don't even know if I want to make those. So do you know what I mean?
Well, look. I realise I've not even mentioned what film we're talking about yet. And So we're talking about the first Irish language film to premiere at Sundance Film Festival, which was the fun fact I was able to find out ahead of this chat. I'm talking about Kneecap, the semi-autobiographical dramatization of the origins of the band Kneecap. But before we get into any details about it, do you want to give what's your brief synopsis that you would do to describe this movie?
I should probably know this by now. I mean, it's a kind of a biopic in real time, telling the story of a rap group in Ireland who rap in Irish, and they're kind of becoming unlikely figureheads of the battle to save the Irish language in modern day Belfast.
Fantastic. Now, usually, I ask people what was the kernel of the idea that led to the film we can see today, but obviously, the subject of the band becomes that. But so in terms of you first coming across the band, how did that interest and or relationship transform into let's make a film about your origin story and the influence you had on making Irish language important in the north of Ireland?
It was really, I just, you know, I went to one of their gigs and just kind of stumbled into one really, and was just blown away by their energy and their charisma. And just, I think, in a world where, bands are often PR'd and packaged and kind of quite safe, to have a band who were throwing baggies of powder into the crowd during the gig was kind of like, oh, okay, there's something, you know, these guys are kind of a bit out there. And I sort of spent the next few months trying to get in touch with them to sort of see if they'd meet me for a pint, very unsuccessfully. And then I happened to bump into one of their ex-girlfriends completely randomly, and that bit of serendipity, I got one of their phone numbers, and that night was sitting in a pub with them, just, you know, having a couple of pints, and I just said, like, I don't know what I want to do, but I want to do a film about, yeah. And they were like, oh, we get approached all the time about doing documentaries, and I'm like, I don't want it to be a documentary, like, I want it to be a narrative feature film. And it's kind of like, I suppose that early stage, it was like, it doesn't make sense at all to make a film about a band that no one's really heard of,
yeah,
in a language that no one really speaks. Like, that's never going to get made, right? Mm. But weirdly, it felt like the complete illogicality of making that film was exactly the reason that we should make that film, right? Mm. It was kind of, it felt so niche and so odd that, I don't know, I just had in my this gut feeling that wouldn't it be cool? And really the expectation at that stage was it was going to be very low budget. It was going to be shot on whatever we could scramble together. We really didn't think it was going to get any proper backing. Mm. And my experience of dealing with funding bodies and stuff is that, certainly a film like this did not seem like the sort of thing that they would be jumping for. So, yeah, that was the level of expectation. And you know, we then kind of that evening kept drinking and ended up back at one of their houses and had a bit of a party. And when I stumbled out at 7 o'clock the next morning, we were firm friends and I signed up to Irish language classes and started this journey of sort of, you know, what really has been from, that was 2019, 5-6 years of getting to where we are now.
I mean, I feel like the central message of the film and the story you're telling is ostensibly true. But I guess, like, I mean, the film I kept thinking about when I was watching it was Winterbottom's 24-Hour Party People. And that, you know, the idea of the mythos and the legend are just important as what you're trying to say. So when you were pulling the script together with the band, how much artistic license did you sort of enjoy together, but pulling it together, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I would say the majority of it's true. Mm. Some of the more mundane stuff is fictionalized, because when you're trying to do a tri-protagonist film, it's no one, like, my advice to anyone listening, never try and do a tri-protagonist film, because it's a nightmare, right? I was like, that thing where you start and really go, I'm going to try and watch some things that have also done tri-protagonist, structures. And then I'm like, I can't find any. And I'm like, uh-oh. That may be because they've been tried and absolutely failed on their ass. So it was a nightmare, because you unless you're Martin Scorsese, you're going to get 3 hours.
Yeah.
Trying to condense kind of these kind of satisfying arcs.
Yeah. Avengers ensemble and things.
Yeah, exactly. And really, it's four stories because you have the three band members, but then the band itself is its own sort of narrative. Yeah. It was tough and also not helped by the fact that the lads were like really determined that no one could be seen as the lead, right? They were all like, they were like, no, you know, so you'd sort of do a draft and then we'd sit in the pub and go through it and they'd be like, I kind of feel like Liam Hogue's the main character here. I'm not happy with that. You know what I mean? You'd be like, for fuck's sake. Like, you know, they're basically line counting. Do you know what I mean? Going like, he's got more line. I'm like, it's not the school play. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're all main characters. It's not like one of you's got a walk-on path as a barista. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's like you're all main characters. And then the almighty row that occurred when it was revealed that Liam Hogue was going to be the narrator. And it was like, no, I want to be the narrator. And I'm like, it's not a debate. Do you know what I mean? It's not a debate we're having here that you can do. It's not that simple, lads, that you can just go, all right, you be the narrator instead, and it'll have no impact at all on the narrative or the perspective. Or we can all be narrators. I'm like, it's not primary school. Do you know what I mean? It's not like everyone gets, you know what I mean? It's like, we're not all sitting here. Like, oh, everyone's got to get a part. So, no, that was always quite amusing. And I think, you know, they are mad fuckers in the best way possible. Mm. But very early on, we developed a relationship that was very open and, you know, we could have big shouting matches and disagreements and then go to a pint and it would all be good. And it was just good fun. And I don't think we could do a film again that has that sense of collaborativeness, of camaraderie, and that level of drug taking.
So I guess for a biopic, the unusual thing for most people that used to see in biopics is the band actually play themselves. Not only did you have to satisfy their what you've just described there in terms of their script presence, but then you literally have to work with them as they're in front of the camera as well. So how did, and they're not actors, are they? Obviously, they're performers. So there's an element of them being show-offs in a sense of they're willing to get up in front of people. But obviously, acting is maybe a tad different than that. And obviously, there's things they have to do which are nothing like performing on stage. So how did you and the band prepare yourselves for sort of that crucial part of the collaboration?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's a real head fuck, the idea of, you know, trying to work within a thing where you're telling people how to be themselves. Do you know what I mean? It's like to direct people playing themselves is to go, well, I don't think that you are being yourself quite as I want you to be you. Right, okay, so it's a weird thing to direct. And obviously, you know, the characters are a bit heightened, but they are their characters. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And, you know, some people are thinking, oh, that must be easy. Just go up there and play yourself. But actually, it's the opposite. Because if I say to you, go and play a 6th century knight, right? Mm. Then you can completely disassociate yourself from that character.
Yeah.
Right? And if you're on screen and people go, I think that guy's a real arsehole. Right, then you go, well, you know, cool, that's the job. I was playing a role.
Yeah.
If you put yourself up on screen, right, and everyone goes, I think that guy's an arsehole, then basically, you know, everyone's saying you're an arsehole.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's a real act of vulnerability there. And so I they were very brave because, the film is not some slapstick kind of take on things. It's a black comedy that has a lot of laughs, but also has some really serious dramatic moment that deal with some pretty deep shit. And you know, they could have shied away from that and gone like, this is not, you know, I suppose you have a stage persona as a rap group, you know, and that is bravado. It's kind of it's quite two-dimensional in a way.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You're there and you're kind of king of the world. But you know, to play a three-dimensional role in a film involves showing vulnerability, involves, you know, showing weakness. And so that was, you know, something that we had to work at, and they were very game for that. They understood that. And, you know, we did about 6 months of acting classes all together. All four of us took the acting class. That was, you know, that was one of the best things I've ever done in terms of in my career, in terms of that process of learning over 6 months what makes actors tick and what their process is,
wow,
is something I am so grateful that I did, because yeah. I think that it gave us a real shorthand on set to understand, you know, how to activate certain things and how to, but also I think, you know, even not working with the lads, but working with other actors in the film, you just suddenly have a language, you know, to share about things. And so I, you know, I would always encourage directors to not get too bogged down in the technicals. And you know, really, I think that, you know, the main job as a director is to get the performances out of the cast. I think that's the, you know, that's the most important thing of, yeah. of anything in the film, is to get the cast performing. And I'm very proud that, you know, I've managed to take those three lads, you know, to a place where they put in the performances they did. That's certainly probably the thing I'm most proud of in the film. I don't even know. What was the question you asked now? I can't remember.
Well, you've answered it. It was very much about how did you prepare? And you've given me a brilliant answer. And I guess, I mean, and the proof of the pudding is that, is like obviously seeing them opposite people like Michael Fassbender, you know, where they don't look overawed and they don't look out of place.
Yeah, well, that was still obviously a concern, was, you know, are they, once they get in there, you know, on set with these big actors, you know, not just Michael Fassbender, Simone Kirby, Jessica, Fanula, you know, the whole cast, Adam Baer, you know, these are all people who are real pros. And I think one thing that that was nailed into them from day one, and that I was always pressing upon them as well, is just how much acting is reacting, right? And it's being present. You know, a lot of the work that we did in those acting classes was all about being present, right? It's all about being in the moment and clearing your head. And, you know, we would do these stupid things, like you'd have to stand opposite each other and just say the first thing about that person, like appearance-wise, that came into your head. No filter. So if they had a spot in the middle of their head, you just had to go, you've got a spot in the middle of your head, you know, you're looking like you haven't slept very much. But the minute you try and filter that, because naturally we don't, you know what I mean, it's like, doesn't matter if it's a good thing or bad thing, the minute you start filtering it, you're in your head, right? And so the minute you pause, you're done.
Okay
It's all about just being so reactive to whatever comes into your head in that moment, right? And at first it was so difficult, we couldn't do it like more than twice before we'd either crack up laughing or just one of us would be like, oh, I can't say that. But by the end, by 6 months later, we were sitting abusing each other for minutes on end. Do you know what I mean? And it was just that thing of just getting used to being absolutely present. And, you know, our acting coach, Kieran Lagan, it was just fantastic at that. And, you know, to when you get on set and you're working with great actors, what great actors do is they give you something to react to, right?
Okay.
Great acting gives you something to bounce off. And bad acting gives you nothing to bounce off.
Yeah.
And so you can't, it's very difficult even for a great actor to put in a really good performance opposite a terrible actor, because they're not giving them anything back. And so, you know, I think that as much as I knew when we were rehearsing and doing our acting classes that the lads were progressing and I was really pleased with where they were, you know, I was absolutely stunned on set when I was seeing what they were really clocking in once the, you know, the camera turned over, that even stunned me and was just so exciting.
I bet. I mean, and the film enjoys sort of a, you know, a frenetic burst of energy, I guess, a reflection of the music and the chaos of what the band's unorthodox journey to where they got to. But also, you're conveying important issues like obviously the Irish language rights that they were that they got involved with fighting for, the mother's sort of, you know, withdrawal from, you know, just life and almost closed off from a son in a way. You know, these are very contrasting elements to the film. So what were some of the things that were in the conversations you had with your DOP, Ryan Kernaghan, is it, about the look and feel and tone of the film? Because obviously they're very jarring, it's different, you know, in as scenes, but obviously you're still working with the same guy who's helping you get the shots right.
Yeah, well, me and Ryan had never worked together before, and it was, I'll be honest, it was kind of nerve-wracking, because it just, the way the funding came together, I needed to find a DOP who was Irish. And, I had DOP friends who I'd worked with for many years and who weren't Irish, and they who I always assumed it'd be, you know, one of them who I'd be working with. And the idea of sort of such a key department having an unknown, you know what I mean? Someone who you haven't got a relationship with. And, yeah. and you know, that relationship can go well or it can go badly. And you know, it's a nightmare if suddenly you find yourself making, you know, your debut narrative feature and you and the DOP just don't see eye to eye, right? So yeah, it's yeah. like, it was certainly felt like, oh, okay, you know, I really need to pick carefully here. And, you know, me and Ryan met up for a cup of coffee with someone who you know, in Ireland is a leading DOP here. And he came, he was carrying a George Saunders book. And George Saunders is my favorite author. And I was like, oh, you're it. And then so we spent about 20 minutes talking about George Saunders. And I was like, you know, like, this is the man. This is, the, you know, if he likes George Saunders, that'll do. That's a good start. And we really got on from the bat. And really, look, the key to this film was pre-production was that, you know, me and him spent couple of months in my kitchen table over Christmas and just storyboarded the absolute arse out of this film. Yeah. Like, there must have been over 1,000 storyboards. And it was like probably, you know, I think that Ryan was, it was one of the most creatively fulfilling processes I've ever had, was sort of being with someone who kind of had the same kind of approach of just trying on every scene, just going, right, what would be a really fun way to shoot this? What would be a really different way to shoot this? And one-upping each other all the time, just trying to find a better way, and never settling, like never going, oh, that'll do. Like, do you know what I mean? It'd be, so we really did challenge each other, and we had neither of us can draw for shit, right? We're both terrible drawers, right? And so we'd sort of do these sketches and sort of notes, and then we'd send them off to a guy called Jack Wright, who lived in Milton Keynes. Yeah, again, complete unknown quantity. I'd found on the internet. Do you know what I mean? And like, you know, as a storyboard artist, I'd found the internet and kind of met a few of them and just liked this guy. He seemed a cool guy, and he was brilliant. You know, he again then bought something extra on top of that. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, then with his own ideas. And I realized at the budget level that we were at and the time that was going to afford us, the idea of shooting this film in what you might call the kind of the safe standard way, you know, you do a wide, you do a mid, you do a tight.
Yeah.
Was just not gonna, you know, that's kind of all we'd have time to do. And I really didn't want it to be that film. I wanted it to feel different. And so I knew if I wanted to try and make it feel different, I needed to be so well planned. Do you know what I mean? I needed to plan this film.
Yeah.
I could turn up on set and know exactly what I wanted every day, shot-wise. And it meant that you could then avoid having to do certain standard shots. Do you know what I mean? You might go, you know what? In this scene, I'm not even going to get wide because I feel so confident in these shots of the story that I don't have to do that. And it was a high-risk game that we were playing.
Can you cite an example from the film where that economy of shooting paid off?
Every bloody scene, mate. Like, you know, I mean, every scene, they're probably like a very standard shot that we've never got. Like, just because we're just like, you know, I feel like we've got to move on.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, I do so many shots here. And you know, there's lots of shots in there that are really technical as well. Like, if we want to do this really technical shot, then that's pretty much all we're going to have time for.
We're going to have
a couple of other things and move on. And, you know, that I think that that involved a lot of discipline. But I said, it was all about the planning. It was all about the planning. And you know, having a great crew who moved quick and understood that, you know, I think that I was quite disciplined. And my AD, Rob Jarrett, I've never made a film without Rob. And he was one of the, I was like, I don't care about, you know, he needs to be my AD, and we're not making the film without him. I'm like, if I've got to get a new DOP, I can survive with that. But like, Rob is my right hand man. Do you know what I mean? Like, Rob knows what I love. Do you know what I mean? And also what I'm not capable of. So. It's that thing that you just want to be able to turn around. He's like, mate, you've got to move on. And or he'll be going, you know, holding everyone off, going, nah, Richard's got this. Give him 5 minutes and he'll get this. So every day was a high wire act. It really was. I remember the one of the producers saying to us earlier, he's like, I'm seeing your shot list here and there's like, you know, 35 shots. Like, you're not going to do more than 20. And I'm like, you know, and I was like, we will. And he's like, no, you won't. Like, you know, you're living in La La Land. And I'm like, we'd never worked together. So I was like, mate, sit down, right? Sit down and watch. We'll do it. And we did. You know, most days we did very well. I mean, there was one day, I remember, we did 55 slates, 55 setups in a day, two cameras, right? No, but, you know, not running all shots, but it was, you know, not over one location either, about four different locations.
Gee whiz.
And it was just, but, you know, I mean, it was mad. I mean, it's like literally you end the day and you're dead. But, I mean, exhilarating, absolutely exhilarating. And the highs and, I mean, equally, there were days and you wouldn't achieve. Right. Do you know what I mean? Where you come out the back of a scene and you go, I did not get those shots I wanted to get. And it's all, you know, it's all gone wrong. And it was really, you know, the weighty silence between me and the DOP, Ryan, sitting in the back of the car on the way back to base, just kind of like, we've fucked this. And you know, the thing is as well, you know, you have to pick yourself up and go again the next day. And some of those things you think are an absolute disaster on the day, you get into the edit and you go, oh, actually, it's all right. It's not that bad.
That's a good segue, because I was going to say, so when you've shot the movie and you've gone through all this, you've picked yourself off the floor each day after each day and stuff. What story discoveries did you make in the edit with Chris Gill and Julian Ulrichs that you maybe weren't apparent when you were writing it and shooting it?
So the film came in at 2 hours 40.
That was your assembly edit.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, there was a lot of babies that needed to be killed. They called me Harold Shipman around the halls of that. that doesn't work. Not Harold Shipman, is it? It's Lucy Letby. But we'll start that again. he killed old people.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today. If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GUNDRYMD.com/energy.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
I fucked up a really dark baby murder joke. Oh, yeah. Dear. If you're going to do a baby murder joke, you better get it right. Do you know what I mean, mate? So anyway, there you go. What was I saying? So yeah, it was, you know, there was a lot of babies needed to be killed in the edit, and that was tough. Like it was a really tough process to distill that down. Now, one thing I will say is that having that many storyboards was a real kind of blessing in the way that, you know, I had pretty much, you know, most of the shots there. Yeah. And so the first edit was just put that, give me that, give me, and the film worked. Do you know what I mean? There was no real
Yeah,
the film on the storyboards, the film in the script is pretty much the film you see. There was no sort of getting the edit and go, oh, we're going to freaking, you know, flip this round. And, you know, no, it didn't happen.
Like, that's amazing. And
they were explored. Like, don't get me wrong. We looked at different options. And, yeah, certain scenes might have been flipped around, have this first. And there were certainly some scenes where they end up becoming intercut. Do you know what I mean? Rather than sitting side by side. So there was some playfulness there. But yeah, we had, there was Chris, there was Julian, but there was also a guy called Dara McKegney, who he was the assembly editor on the film.
Right.
And, you know, Chris came in quite late to kind of help. You know, I think, you know, me and Julian did most, Julian worked in the longest and we kind of got it to a place story-wise. You know, I think Julian did an amazing job of helping with the emotion and the story and the beats of it. And then Chris came in, and Chris has got a background of really giving things pizzazz and punch and kind of momentum, energy. And then Chris only had a small window for another job. And so he came in, and then there was still work that we needed to do. And so I said, look, I really like this guy, Dara, right? He was a great assembly editor. And I just felt he was really young. He'd never done it. You know, he had never had an editing credit at this point. And they were like, well, you can't get a guy who's an assistant editor to finish the film. And I was like, really? Can't I? I think I can. And if I want it, I have it, right? Don't tell me. I can have to edit the film. So I got Dara, and he was fantastic. I mean, like, you know, Dara really, really did take it to another level again, which was he really got the dirty aesthetic I was going for, which is really dirty cut, really jarring cuts, and just kind of, you know, I think that maybe when you've worked in the industry a long time, sometimes there's like, but you can only cut things so fast because you're so well trained. Kind of like, no, that's the limit. Trust me, that's the limit. And Dara, I think, didn't come with quite that baggage, and was like, oh yeah, we'll just shave 5 frames off that. And it was just like, and you know, we were just, it became so frenetic that even us, we were looking at each other going, it's just a bit too much. And they'd be like, you know what, fuck it. Because, you know, here's the thing, I would say for every creative element of this film, I always went back to this one philosophy, which was, if I'm getting my shot to make my narrative feature film, I'm going to do it exactly the way that I want to do it. And I don't care if that absolutely falls on its ass, right? Yeah, if it's a complete flop and everyone goes, what, you know, what load of shit. That's okay. I can live with that, right? I can be disappointed, but I can live with it. What I can't live with is that I had my chance and I went in and I allowed myself to get distracted by other people, what other people wanted, to allow other people's viewpoints and things like that to start taking away from my vision and you know, watering it down. So I knew there was going to be a process of people trying to water it down because it was quite, you know, it was quite a punchy film in many ways. If suddenly it flops, then I'm sitting there going, well, what if? What if I've just made my film rather than allowing all these other people to kind of make the film they wanted to make? And that's not about saying that you don't listen to people, because you're working with amazing team of people, HODs, who bring ideas and elevate things. But, you know, I think it's so easy when you've got so many people around. And we had like 11 different funders. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. It's so easy.
I looked at your producer list. I couldn't believe how long it was on the IMDb credits.
18 executive producers.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, it was, you know, notes. It was difficult getting so many notes. And you know, it's easy, I think, to get lost amongst all that. Because
were you the point where all the notes were coming? There wasn't somebody between you and the notes. You were getting notes from all the angles and you were having to decipher what you were going
to do. You know, the thing is, the BFI, what they saw the film as, was always going to be different to what the Irish Language Broadcast Fund saw the...
Of course, film. Yeah.
And so, you know, and with creative things, you know, here's another thing. It's like, you know, the truth or the right decision doesn't exist in the middle of the two things. If someone's got a note at one end of the scale and someone's got a note at the other end of the scale, going, well, you know what, I'll do the thing in the middle, is rarely the right thing to do, because you're a nothing middle ground of wishy-washy shot.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there was a pro, you know, I'm pretty robust when it comes to these things, and was just sort of, there was a lot of me just going, no, thanks, but no thanks. Do you know what I mean? And you know, that didn't make me that popular at times, and yeah, that's okay. But yeah, you know, there's obviously have been, you know, when you've been quite intransigent about certain things, and there's certain scenes, moments in the film, which, you know, I had a lot of pushback on, like, you know, right up until, you know, the final weeks of like people trying to change things and that I resisted. And when I'm, no, I believe in this, right? And there is a sense of vindication when you finally get the film out and you read reviews, you'll go, we really love that scene. And you're like, yeah, fuck you all.
Well, look, thank you very much for sharing all that about making of the film. I mean, we're recording this on the 20th of July. The film's going to hit British cinemas 8th of August, isn't it? And I think it's 20th.
I know. It's 2nd of August in America. It's 8th of August in Ireland. And it's 23rd of August. In the rest of the UK.
I will put that in the show notes and links and stuff. Reading the reviews around the film, a lovely thing I read by Robert Daniels in the Roger Ebert site. I don't know if you've come across that review, where he just summed it up lovely. He said, "Kneecap becomes a reminder of how music can make individuals be seen by dogmatic authorities, common communities, and most importantly, each other." And I thought that summed up the film beautifully. Moving swiftly along, after that discussion of Kneecap, we're going to talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Now, for those tuning in for the first time, this is three films that Rich has given me that are important to him. And every 5 minutes, we're going to hear this sound. You can hear that at your end, okay?
I can.
So when DEFCON 1 starts, that's the signal for us to end the discussion on that film and move on to the next film. Okay, that seemed fair enough to you, Rich?
That's fair enough.
Let us start with the first of your selection, 2001's Amelie. Where you found this film? Why does this hold such fond memories for you? What is it about Amelie?
Well, I mean, my second-born daughter is called Amelie. And that's not an accident. So, you know, it is sitting in my living room downstairs with a big Amelie poster. So I kind of felt morally obliged to choose this as one of my top three. My youngest daughter did say to me, why am I not named after, her name's Callia. She's like, why am I not named after one of your favorite films? And I was like, well, I don't think you want to be called Trainspotting or Dumb and Dumber. So I probably ruined what the next two films are now, haven't I? But anyway, round to Amelie. Look, when I first saw that film, I think it's a film that, if you look at Kneecap, there's kind of a similarity. Frenetic editing, right? There's moments in the film that really, you know, the color palette and the sort of boldness of the creative decisions was something that blew me away, and was just like, it's really... It was at a time when I first watched it, when I probably hadn't watched a lot of foreign language films. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it was suddenly being oh, there's a whole world of cinema out there beyond, you know, what...
It's a lovely moment, that, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it just felt so bold a vision, right? Mm. It was too unique in its take in so many ways that it just always stuck me. And it became one of those films that I'd often go back to for creative inspiration. I remember sort of prepping Kneecap, and it was a film that I watched a couple of times, not for any particular reason other than these sort of things that can be achieved. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, this is a creative vision, you know, you can do a bold creative vision too, right? And you know, and yeah, it's I remember the sex scene, the montage sex scene always sticks out in my head. Like, it's a really like a really fast cut, lots of people shagging. I don't know why, but it always sticks in my head. It's just being so fun. So fun, like some quite unattractive people, lots of them just shagging, very quick cut. And it's just one of those scenes that I always just cracks me up laughing. I don't know why. I must be a pervert.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess we would have grown up, if you think of like late 80s, 90s, where sex scenes were always soft focus. They were always shite music. Yeah. There was never the idea of it being dirty or fun. It was a performance for nobody, really. But obviously in the films, it looked like sex looked so false.
Yeah, it's Channel 5 late night.
Something like that, yeah. Now, Audrey Tautou is the lead in Amelie, and I don't know. When I was getting ready for this, I was reading that the part was originally written for Emily Watson.
Was it?
Yeah, and she wanted the part, but had to decline because she didn't speak French for starters, and had already signed up for Gosford Park. I mean, that's kind of a real weird sliding door, isn't it?
That is a weird start. I can't imagine it. Well, look, it says very much about how she did the role that I couldn't imagine anyone else doing it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She was so perfect in that role. I mean, Emily Watson's done all right. I don't think she'll be on the dub time soon.
And the director began collecting memories and events that make up the story of Emily back as far back as 1974, apparently. Which is like, that's some prep, that, isn't it?
That is some prep, but I think you can tell it. You can tell it's such an idiosyncratic film that it's not the sort of thing you could knock together in 6 months. Do you know what I mean? It's something that would have to be with you for years and years and years to kind of those little moments, those little beats, little vignettes within it. It's a film that just speaks to a passion for filmmaking and a passion for telling a story. Right?
I did that, where did you see it originally? How did you originally see it? Did you see it at the cinema, or did you catch it on?
I can lie if you want and tell you I remember, but I have no idea.
That's fine.
I have absolutely no idea. When I can't remember where I first saw it. No, I don't know. I don't know that one.
And given you said it was almost like a gateway to sort of, you know, this idea of the foreign language cinema, what? Do you remember then what film did you then, did that lead you to?
I kind of had some of my favourite films are French films, like La Haine is a film I absolutely loved. And in Kneecap, there's a scene where JJ's in a mirror, like trying on his balaclava, which is a complete pastiche.
Oh, there's our first 5 minutes, sir. Do you want to finish that thought?
I don't know. You tell me. I don't know the rules. I don't know how strict the rules are.
Well, look, let us move swiftly along then to 1996. A clue was already given in the first bit. We're going to talk about... Now, this is, for me, this is a real favorite for me on two levels. A, it's an amazing movie. But B, the director is from my hometown. Danny Boyle... I'm talking about 1996's Trainspotting. Yeah, Danny Boyle's from a town in North Manchester called Radcliffe. Which,
is that right?
When he won the Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire, he brought the world's media to St. Margaret's Catholic Club in Radcliffe. And it's amazing seeing that and my mate's dad just pass by in the background while he's getting interviewed. And I was like, hats off to you, man.
It was funny when we were, you know, I'm a big Danny Boyle fan, and I remember I was our composer, Mikey J. Santi. He was, I was on the phone to him talking about some stuff for the film. And he said, he was working with Danny Boyle at the time on a show in Manchester, the opening show, Matrix. He was working on Matrix, the stage show with Danny. And he said, Danny walked in earlier and I was watching Kneecap. And he went, oh, what's that? And he sat and watched, you know, a few sheets of it with
wow.
me. And I was like, fuck off. You're kidding me? And he's like, yeah, yeah. And it's like the chase scene, which is one of the kind of iconic scenes of the film, I'd say. Can you call scenes in your own film iconic? I don't know, but I did it.
Somebody's got to call it first. So what is it? What is it about Trainspotting though for you? Where are you seeing that first time?
I mean, I think it's at a mate's house. I think was the first time that I saw Trainspotting, and you know, for me it was like there wasn't many films to my memory that were so specific in their location, in their, you know, I'd read Trainspotting the book,
okay,
and. Yeah, that was something that was a real eye opener for me as a writer. Do you know what I mean? Like the being so colloquial and sort of so true to the language of a place. And the film itself, just, you know, the way it opens, just that frenetic, that beat drop in and just the madness, and you're just hooked, you're in, right?
Absolutely.
And
it
felt so new and fresh, and you know, the specificity of it. Became a, you know, was it why it was such a universal hit? And maybe that's something that really sort of stuck with me, is the idea that you can make something that is super, super specific.
Yeah.
But it's going to resonate with people all over the place because of that. And in a way, you know, Kneecap is a film that's about a very specific place, the Gaeltacht in West Belfast, 2019. In the same way that, you know, Trainspotting was about skagheads in Edinburgh in, you know, 1990, whatever. And so, you know, it's a film that I think is very much stuck with me. One, yet again, that I must have, you know, you return to, you watch. And there's just certain films that if you were flicking through the TV and they're on, you stop and you just watch them.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and Trainspotting, every time you watch it, there's something new, there's something fresh about it. And it's been copied so many times. You think of how their use of graphics, transitions, things like that just became ubiquitous,
yeah.
Right? There's so many copycat things. And with Kneecap, there was a few sort of early people going, this is the Belfast Trainspotting, which I hated because there must have been so many films that you've seen over the years which have popped up being like, this is the Brighton Trainspotting, this is the Manchester Trainspotting, this is the Dublin Trainspotting. And invariably, they were fucking shite, right? And so so I was like, it's the kiss of death. It's the absolute kiss of death to be called the anything Trainspotting. You're never going to live up to that. And Kneecap will never live up to that. It's a different beast entirely from that. But there are similarities. I we've got a very overt reference in the film where JJ disappears into a bin, right? And it's my doff of the cap to Danny Boyle in the toilet, the worst toilet in Scotland, right? And I like, you know, for me, I think some filmmakers kind of don't like the idea of people thinking they don't know every, you know, they didn't come up with everything on their own. And I think that it's much more fun to admit that there's very little new in the world,
yeah,
and be able to be a bit more meta about it and kind of, you know, just have fun. Like, do you know what I mean? Have fun with the idea that, yeah, I am taking inspiration from other people's films and I am, you know, and don't hide it. Just be like, yeah, this is out of that film. That's my personal taste. I like that fun.
Well, I mean, Tarantino's literally made a career out of it, hasn't he? I mean,
there you go. He's done all right.
He's done all right. Do you know that the worst toilet in Scotland was actually chocolate and smelled quite pleasant, apparently, on set? So there's the magic of cinema for you.
I've never actually thought I wondered what it was. I mean, I knew it wasn't shit, but
there's our 5 minutes, sir.
These 5 minutes go quickly, don't they? Thank God.
Right then. I want to say a shift in tone, but I'm not sure it is. We're going to jump back 2 years to a film I saw this at the cinema and, you know, laughed the proverbial tits off myself. Talking about Dumber and Dumber, the Farrelly Brothers film starring Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels.
Dumb and Dumber, not Dumber and Dumber.
Sorry, Dumb and Dumber.
you can't get the title right. Well, look, this is one that I do remember exactly where I watched this. I was about 10 years old, and being around a mate's house, and he going to Blockbuster. We went to Blockbuster.
Okay.
Video, and got his mum let us select a film to watch that night on a Saturday.
So where
night.
Are we? What Blockbuster are we in? Where are we for this Blockbuster?
In Blockbuster in Egham, okay. Right, in Middlesex, near Staines.
Nice one.
And we picked up Dumb and Dumber, and it was a 12, but we were, but her mum was like, it's all good. It's all good. So we felt like we were bad boys right there, and got home and not really knowing what to expect, as you do when you're 10. And I just don't think I've ever laughed so hard watching a film to this day. Like, just found it so, so, so funny. And it stuck with me. I mean, like, how funny me and him were just rolling around laughing at it and the stupidity of it. And for me, it's Jim Carrey's finest role. Like, I think he's the... and Jeff Daniels as well. I think the two of them in that film are just brilliant. And I kind of wanted to bring this one in because I don't know, as a filmmaker, sometimes you're going to go, oh, I need to think of some high-minded films to bring to make myself feel really refined and kind of filmmakery. But I was like, you know what? Actually, no, I'm not, Dumb and Dumber. Like, it's a mainstream film. It's a stupid mainstream film. But just a comic brilliance, do you know what I mean? Of just two great performers, a great script, and, just some, to this day, quote Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was interesting, like, getting ready for this, reading about it, was Jeff Daniels had to fight for the role. Like, the producers wanted another comedian to play opposite Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey was like, I want someone to play off.
Yeah.
And... three of his agents didn't want him to do it. They were like, this is going to ruin your career.
Amazing.
Well, I mean, just thinking about what you were saying before about wanting to make your own decisions and stuff, it's like the people throwing in this advice at the point when the film's not made, so it doesn't exist. So therefore, like you said, there is no right answer. There is just what you believe to do. And basically, Jim Carrey was the one that helped get that over the line. Because
that is interesting, because you're right. I mean, you do get a lot of opinions, and certainly, when you're thinking about, I'm in a blessed position where I'm looking at what I might be doing next and things like that. And everyone's got opinions, and you can kind of get lost in that a little bit sometimes. Mm. And it's good to remind yourself is that ultimately no one knows anything. Do you know what I mean? And you just have to make your own choices. But yeah, again, another role. Could you imagine someone other than Jeff Daniels doing that role? And I just, you can't.
And I don't think it ever struck me. I don't know about, I mean, you were 10, but I mean, I don't ever think it's ever struck me in watching that film that Jim Carrey's the comedian, Jeff Daniels is not.
Oh, no, absolutely not. But also, the film that I watched at 10, watched through my teenage years, watched in my 20s, if it came on now, I'd see him watch it and I'd laugh. And there's something very special about that, is that a film that, can last that many decades and that many periods of your own life, and you still find funny. And I don't know, maybe there's people out there who think Dumb and Dumb is a fucking horrible, stupid film and rubbish. I don't know. I've never met them, but there must be people who don't like it.
Well,
I
just find the great Dustin Hoffman apparently called Jim Carrey to say that it was one of the most genuine and authentic friendships he's ever seen on film. So for a big daft comedy film, actually, there's a big heart in there, isn't there? I mean, I think that's why it's enduring. I mean, there is obviously some fantastic slapstick, which the Farrelly brothers are, kings of, kind of thing. But, the reason why this film endures more than other films they've made is because we actually care about them for some daft reason.
I'm just sitting here thinking of some of the moments. When he gets robbed by the old lady, trying to buy a paper. And he tapes the bird's head back on and gives it to the blind kid.
given the thing about like people's opinions though, that film became Jim Carrey's third in the same year number one box office. Like The Mask and Ace Ventura, Pet Detective were also number one box office. So.
Well, they say they don't do movie stars anymore. And that's I kind of agree with that in a way. It's like, you've got Deadpool and Wolverine out there at the moment and big movie. But, Jim Carrey. Oh,
finish your thought. Go on. Jim Carrey what?
Jim Carrey, at that time, was a real movie star, wasn't he? I mean, he was huge, huge, huge. The movie business don't work like that anymore.
Well, look, Kneecap is going to be out in August. Do you want to remind people what the dates are?
Yeah, so America, 2nd of August, then Ireland, 8th of August, and UK, 23rd of August. Go watch it, please.
And thank you for and thank you for sharing your three films that have impacted everything in adult life. That was really fun.
Thank you for having me, mate.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Allo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/try.